So I'm Rick Hansen, and it's November 25th, 2015, and this is the day before Thanksgiving, as you probably know. And so an obvious topic is gratitude, and I want to frame that topic in a larger context and see what you think about all this. And the larger context has to do with what is called in Buddhism the three fundamental pillars of practice. Three pillars of practice. And a way of thinking about it is that in the fundamental undertaking of the Buddha, he was trying to get at what causes suffering and what would cause the end of suffering. Right? And so he then summarized those causes of a lasting, unconditional happiness in a world of conditional arising and passing away. He organized the causes of that fundamental fulfillment of our heart's longing in terms of, in Pali, the language of early Buddhism, sila, panya, and samadhi. Sila being virtue, defined mainly in terms of restraint, not stealing, not killing, not abusing intoxicants, not abusing sexuality, not abusing speech, but also described affirmatively as in expressing loving kindness, right livelihood, right speech, right action, helping rather than hurting. So that's the virtue of pillar of practice. That's pretty classic religious stuff, right? If you want to be enlightened, clean up your act. That helps you pragmatically to be less entangled with other people and therefore have more attention for your own practice. And your mind is then not clouded because you're virtuous. Your mind is not clouded with remorse, self-criticism, preoccupations with other people, and you get to enjoy what could be called the bliss of blamelessness. That's the sila, restraint, moderation, morality. Aspect of practice. The second group of causes of liberation, no small matter, are clustered under the heading of wisdom. Insight into impermanence, insight into the causes, gross and subtle, of our own suffering. What happens when we get preoccupied with our case against somebody else? What happens when we are mean to ourselves, harsh to ourselves? Put pressure, too much pressure on ourselves from the inside. What happens? There's insight there. And a larger sense of wisdom into the nature of experience itself, distinct from content of experience, just experience as experience. What is hearing like? What is seeing like? What are the ways that hearing, seeing, thinking, remembering, wanting, any form of phenomenology, what are the ways that they're like each other? What are their qualities? What's their nature? And with wisdom, there's a growing insight into the insubstantial nature of experience. It's non-substantiality. It's not absolute existingness. And therefore, that it can't be clung to no matter how hard we try. We're actually not able to hold on to any experience. And in the recognition of that fact, again and again, ever more deeply, we start holding our experience more lightly. We start craving it less, clinging to it less, and thus we suffer less and we become happier and more peaceful. Okay, wisdom. A lot of wisdom teachings, right? But then there's this third pillar of practice. And what's interesting about the first two is they sound kind of dry. Be a good person and understand the truth, right? Be a good person sounds kind of top down, get a grip, control yourself, maybe a certain amount of bottom up virtue, but it's a lot of top down self-regulation. And then we have wisdom, sounds pretty abstract, conceptual. Oh yeah, I want to take a class in wisdom, okay? But then there's this third pillar of practice, which is really juicy. And it's the group of causes of liberation under the heading of samadhi. What is samadhi? Samadhi is an ancient Indian term. The Buddha was a real yogi 2,500 years ago, deeply trained, deeply practiced, fully committed to his own practice, in a context in which samadhi was considered to be luscious, blissful, non-ordinary states of consciousness that were deeply embodied, very much in our own experience. So what is thankfulness? What is gratitude? You know, what is that sense of appreciating, let's say, other people, or just awe, or the gift of life itself? It's an experience, isn't it? It's embodied. It's in the body. And, you know, I was talking with my wife about this before coming here tonight, and she said, wow, I don't normally hear people talk about vipassana or insight, you know, practice in this way, as a very embodied, sensory, sensual, emotionally positive concentration. That's a lot of what samadhi means. A concentration in wholesome experiences that are so rewarding, there's no basis for fearing anything, resisting anything, defending against anything. You're just so lusciously embedded in joy or bliss or happiness or contentment or tranquility or gratitude that grasping falls away, craving falls away. Wow. To put it a certain kind of way, to use terms that can be misused, obviously, take it with a grain of salt, this is the feminine aspect of Buddhism. You know, if top-down regulation or, you know, intellectual, conceptual insight, wisdom, could be characterized, you know, controversially sometimes, as more quote-unquote masculine, and this part is very embodied, very receptive, very marinating, coming home to, being intimate with your own experiencing. And I think, honestly, that when Buddhism came to the West, it said that there were three pillars of practice, and I think it tended to leave one back in Asia, the samadhi pillar. And if it said that in Buddhism there are three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, we left one of the jewels back in Asia, Sangha, community. And there's kind of a corrective that's happening of bringing more community in and also more focus on concentration and samadhi and the experiential lusciousness and the positive, happy aspects of practice. There's a corrective that's occurring there. So I want to talk with you tonight about your own samadhi practice and why it's good to look for with some skillfulness. In other words, in particular, not trying to hold on to them or pile them up or cling to them, but the benefits of emotionally positive experiences. Under this heading of, this is one of the three great pillars of practice. So first off, any comments or questions so far?
So it's the English translation would be concentration.
Samadhi, you know, you could translate it differently. It's basically, you could say, bliss, or you could describe it as a kind of mental training in general around meditation. The samadhi pillar of practice is sort of the wise mindfulness, wise concentration, wise effort aspect of the Eightfold Path. So it's the experiential aspect of the training. You could say that sila is the moral aspect and wisdom, you know, is the sort of understanding aspect. But morality and understanding are not enough. We have to feel something in our own bodies that's rewarding, that's motivating. And also because we feel ideally kind of lusciously peaceful, contented, and happy, safe, satisfied, and connected. Peaceful, contented, and loving. Because we feel that way, when we feel that way, there's like, why crave? We don't need anything else. If you're kind of embedded in bliss and joy and love, right, in that moment, you're not looking for anything else. You're not on the hunt. Yeah, this is great. I want to know. And I want to, you know what, if I want you to get anything out of tonight, It's to feel like it's really okay to be delighted. It's really skillful means to marinate in a bliss that's so deep that it makes you free.
So maybe if you're meditating and the bliss is not necessarily deep, but you are enjoying things that come up and moving this way.
Sure.
And you're able to look and see if you're grasping that.
Yeah.
Is that a beginning experience?
That's wonderful. That's not just the beginning, that's the middle and the end, in a lot, I think, in a lot of ways. And it supported, the three pillars of practice support each other, because we need the morality part, right? Otherwise, we'll start chasing blisses and so forth in problematic ways, right? And we also need the wisdom part, just like you're saying. We realize that as soon as we start going, oh man, this tranquility is so luscious, it's gone, right? As soon as we try to hold on to it, it starts going away, or we turn it into a thing. But yeah, that's exactly right. And I'm very struck by how often, even people who are quite experienced in practice, when they ask a question or make a comment, it's often abstract or theoretical. It's not close to our own experience. And if anything, meditation is about experiencing, right? It's not about understanding. It's about experiencing. Yeah.
Yeah. A few things. One is, what I'm hearing is the samadhi, we can get there kinesthetically.
Yeah.
It feels, being very kinesthetic is a doorway into the samadhi-ness of it all. And I'm also hearing, when you're in a state where you have a blast of dopamine happening, that feels pretty much like samadhi. If I may, I don't know if I'm using these words exactly correct, but I know when I have a rush of dopamine, I'm feeling pretty blissful.
Right.
But we know that dopamine eventually will go away and shift.
Right.
So it's almost like a fake samadhi, not really fake, but you get a good indication of what that bliss could feel like, where you're in that mode, you have a dopamine rush, and you don't need anything else but what you're doing right at that moment.
Right. Oh, there's so much that's good and it's interesting what you're saying. So a couple of things. One, I'm sure some monks and some professors are spinning in their graves with the loose way I'm using the terminology. I mean, I respect the term samadhi when it's applied narrowly as non-ordinary states of consciousness that are usually achieved as an achievement after, you know, years of training and certainly after days of concentrated practice like on retreat, you know. So if you've ever experienced one of those moments where you're just dropped into, opened into, blasted into one of those non-ordinary states where, without drugs, you know, having done it through drugs, I'm talking about not drugs, where whatever it might be, it might have a quality of this very, a lot of bliss in the body. You might feel just utterly peaceful in the mind. You might have a sense of just oneness with everything. You know, your whole perceptual frame of reference is just blown open. Whatever it might be, that's a radically different kind of experience. That's sort of the narrow meaning of the word samadhi. And there are particular four, you could say, well known in the Buddhist time, kinds of samadhi called the jhanas, these four particular states that constitute the right concentration element of the Eightfold Path in Buddhism. And they're described very psychologically, but they are clearly non-ordinary states of consciousness. And teachers in different traditions, some people would say you need to lose all sense of the normal sensory surround to be in one of the jhanas. Other people say, you know, that's not evident in the Buddha's teachings of, you know, certainly of the time. And in fact, you can still have some awareness of what's happening around you while you're in these bliss states. Okay? That's sort of the narrow sense. And there are people who really focus on that in their practice. I'm deliberately trying to use the term more generally. and to really point to this aspect of practice, which, notwithstanding the ways that America is this so-called sensual, you know, party culture, we have a strong Puritan work ethic culturally. And I think that in Buddhism, you know, generally it's got this kind of rap, for good reason, as this kind of dour, grim, effortful, serious, bummer religion. And I think that something's missing. And I think we're, a lot of us, me included, have tended to steer away from the samadhi pillar of practice. And what a wonderful time of year, Thanksgiving, to kind of reorient around it. So that, and then the question is the way into it, kind of in what you were saying. There are many ways into it. One of the great ways into it is to just pick an object of attention, like the sensations of breathing at your upper lip, literally something very narrow, or a kind of a word sound in your mind like om or peace, right? Or a repetitive prayer, maybe with a rosary, Mother Mary. I mean, you could work with all kinds of things. Or the sensations of breathing in the body as a whole, whatever it is, and just lock onto it in a really muscular way and say, I'm going to do this thing. Concentration is a doorway in. Another doorway in that I really use a lot myself is fearlessness, undefended. You know, to realize in this moment, I'm utterly all right. You know, you just, like there is ongoing, and you just tune into your sensations, the body. The body's ongoing. Fantastic. Just kind of open wide, you know. And you can do that as well with, I think, the two other great needs we have for satisfaction and connection. You can notice that, oh, wow, you know, there's actually nothing missing in this moment of experiencing. Right? I'm already kind of full. And you also can have a sense of, wow, I'm loved, I'm loving, I'm connected. I find that is a very powerful way in, too. So there are different ways in. Gratitude is a beautiful practice. It, for me, bangs on especially the contentment bell, the satisfaction need that we have is a broad umbrella term. But there you are. Gratitude's great. You're just sitting. Wow, how grateful. And you can notice that in your gratitude, any kind of craving is just falling away. Right? One last thing about dopamine. Dopamine tracks rewards. It's a neurotransmitter, so it kind of pulses. And so for one, it's not very involved in the actual experience, which is what I'm really talking about here. I'm trying to really bring attention into this experiencing. And I think the Buddha's radical teaching, I talked about this last week, is that if you really are in your experiencing, you'll recognize that in almost any moment of experiencing, there's actually no problem. There's no basis for craving of any kind. Like, wow. Okay, so we're talking about experiencing. Dopamine tends to track rewards, but it's not so much the experience of reward. And it pulses. But here's this really amazingly, totally bizarre and cool thing. Dopamine is a more evolved molecule, came along later, it's harder to build, and it's big, it's fat. Okay, so it doesn't tend to leak. But there are these ancient little molecules, oxytocin, as one, and these endogenous opioids, these reward molecules. They're both released in pulses when neurons fire, but they also ooze out of the cell bodies of neurons, and they ooze out of these long little wires, axons, that connect neurons to each other, literally. It's called paracrine. You know, there's the endocrine system, the hormonal system. Then there's this neurotransmitter oozing called paracrine transmission. And basically, it just means that we can spice up the cerebral soup and tilt it one way or another based on how we condition the kind of oozing out of our neurons. Like, does this sound bizarre or super cool? Right? So with repeated practice, we can, you know, there's not like studies about this, but it's plausible what I'm saying, and it makes sense. We can gradually tilt the release and therefore the concentrations of these neurotransmitters in the cerebrospinal fluid and in the nervous system altogether, that gooey, mushy stuff there. So it's more inclined toward just kind of feeling safe, happy, and loved already. Follow that? And that's what happened. I think that's the opportunity over time. And as we feel already safe, happy, and loved, the second noble truth starts falling away. There's less and less trouble. There's less and less problem or threat, you know, or striving orientation. And we still dream big dreams. We still say what we need to say. We still show up for work. You know, we get up early to make the pies that we got to bring to the Thanksgiving tomorrow, let's say. But more and more, we're like already safe, happy, and loved inside. You ever think that's what Buddhism was really about? I think that's what it's really about. The Buddha just landed. He was like, no problem. You know, he pulled his hand away from the hot fire. He pulled a kid out of traffic, a rushing ox cart or something, you know. But there was no problem. Yeah.
I can focus on the sort of okayness and a lot of times intense physical pain, and so I try to find a place, another part of the body to kind of balance it, like hold other things in my attention. Don't try to deny the pain, but just try to sort of focus on a broader focus that includes other things, kind of balances out. And I do think I get to that sort of okayness, you know, okay already, even though I'm in pain, but I would never call it bliss. And so I'm curious if there's any... Yeah. You know, is that enough? I mean, or is there something I'm missing or other?
That's a really good question. So for one, it is true that in this, you know, in the Buddha Dharma, the seven factors of awakening. So we have mindfulness, investigation, energy or effort. Then we have bliss, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. And that factor, the bliss factor, is described as bliss, just piti in Pali, distinct from sukha, which is sweetness, because it's the base of the, or root of the word for sugar, sucrose, sukha, sweetness. It's the happiness factor. So on the one hand, there is an emphasis on bliss, okay? And this is also to remind us a yogic tradition in which it was just presumed that you were doing spiritual practice most of the time, right? And, you know, bliss is, I think, more accessible if we're doing a lot of, like, retreat practice or sustained practice, which most of us don't have the ability to do in modern Western householder cultures. Or even in the East, most people don't have the chance to do that if you're not a monastic and supported by a community. All right. But, on the other hand, my own view is that while bliss is useful and powerful, maybe, you know, that really what it's like a sprint. Bliss is like a sprint, but happiness, the joy factor of sukha, is like a marathon. It's continuous. It's much more accessible, and the bliss factor tends to fall away into what you could think of as kind of a global well-being or all-rightness in which pain is occurring. It's hard to be blissful when we're in pain, a lot of pain. But on the other hand, there can be a feeling of all-rightness and well-being and even happiness in which there is also pain, you know. And there can even be almost an ecstasy at realizing that we can find sanctuary outside the pain, right? And I find that very, very helpful. And it was helpful for me as well. A key teacher of mine, Christina Feldman, talked about the sukha factor of joy as having three aspects: happiness, contentment, and tranquility. And If you want, you can do this in your home practice. You can explore the so-called five jhana factors at home. If you want to, so let's get practical, okay? So one, you got it. With the authority invested in me by the Buddha himself, taking some license here, it's okay to be happy, to be grateful. In fact, it's good to cultivate emotionally positive experiences, not out of striving. That's where the wisdom aspect comes in, and not, you know, in ways that harm yourself and others. That's the virtue aspect. But it's really okay that, A, mainly when you're having them, be there for it. You know, when in the moment there's the relief of feeling that it's okay to be undefended, you're actually all right. Enjoy it. You know, when you're with your friends and it feels good, enjoy it, right? You're like, it's a full moon tonight. It's okay, enjoy it. You know, when you're thinking of someone you care about and it makes you feel happy, enjoy it, right? I have a pond in my backyard, you know, we finally got it fixed. What a nightmare, but anyway, you know, I put out little food for the fishies. They rise to the surface. I think, oh, how happy they must be having something to eat. And, you know, food is arriving. I'm happy for them, right? It's natural. So it's kind of stay with it, right? Okay, the pumpkin pie tastes yummy. It's nice to be warm on a cold day. You know, there you are, you walk to your car, it's cold. You get in your car, it's warm. Yeah, it feels warm. Really, because in that moment, when it feels good, you're not craving, are you? Isn't that interesting, right? It's a beautiful moment. And also, it's okay to do little things, to deliberately cultivate, you know, wholesome, positive emotion and states. And I, as you know, I use this model, you know, reptile, mammal, primate, human, stages of evolution, lizard, mouse, monkey, safety, satisfaction, connection, as a kind of framework, a little inner checklist. Like, in other words, like I have three, it's kind of like I have six lights on my inner dashboard. You know, three of them are red, three of them are green, two for each system, right? And I'm just kind of checking internally. Safety, red or green? Can I do little things to recognize that it's okay to have it be green, right? Satisfaction, red or green? Can I do little things to stabilize green? And same with the connection system, love. Do I need to feel angry or resentful or left out or inadequate? Or, can I authentically locate feeling liked, feeling loved, feeling loving myself, feeling caring, feeling, connected with all of nature? Green, right? So far? So clear? Right? Okay, that's good in general, right? Like, hey, green lights are good. It's okay, right? That's practice. It's amazing to realize this is a fundamental spiritual practice in the Buddhist system to help your inner dashboard go green and marinate in the feeling of it experientially, intimately in your own body. Okay?
Safety.
Satisfaction. Connection. My joke summary is pet the lizard, feed the mouse, hug the monkey. Now you remember it, right? But yeah, it's really true. If you think about it, you know, there are probably a few core needs we have that are not in that neat framework, but so much rests in those three. And if you think about it also classically in psychology, we have avoiding pain, call that the safety system. And then we have approaching pleasure, call that the satisfaction system. In Buddhist psychology, we have, you know, aversion to the unpleasant, that's the safety framework in my model. It's that box. Then we have grasping the pleasant. In the Buddhist psychology, that would be approaching satisfaction. And then I really think it's important to call out the relational field. That's kind of more than just some combination of avoiding pain and approaching pleasure. So then I call out there, I call it clinging to what's heartfelt. Right? It's the attaching system. So I think of three broad motivational systems, avoiding, approaching, and attaching. Safety, satisfaction, connection, lizard, mouse, monkey. And you can kind of feel it moment to moment. Is my mind colored by fear or by a sense of peace in terms of safety? Is my mind colored by frustration or a sense of contentment? I'm just looking for umbrella, single terms. Is my mind colored by a sense of heartache or love? And then how can I authentically marinate in the more wholesome of those, peace, contentment, love, and how can I gently nudge myself virtuously and wisely, sila and panya, virtuously and wisely, to dial out of fear, frustration, and heartache and into peace, contentment, and love, and help that become more and more the soup I marinate in, neurochemically as well as psychologically.
Is that framework in one of your...
Yeah, it's in... That's right. I just, it's on a fortune cookie I read once. No, it's in Hardwiring Happiness. That's where I put it, Hardwiring Happiness, that framework. And I got to say, you know, as a ready Lord of the Rings geek, I hope you get the reference there, I bet you will. You know, we have basically three needs, safety, satisfaction, connection, two settings, you know, reactive for craving and suffering, responsive for not craving and true happiness. And one practice to rule them all, which is to repeatedly cultivate and marinate in the wholesome, to take in the good. Yeah. Right? Got it? You see my...
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. At least one person laughed. Okay, right? Okay, good. So, that okay so far? I want to end definitely on time. Cool, good. So, home practice. Meditating, if you want. You can really cultivate some of these factors of samadhi, including non-ordinary states of consciousness. And there are five traditional jhana factors. How many of you have not heard of this term, the jhana factors? Oh, half the people, great, good. So there'll be some value opportunity here. The jhanas are these non-ordinary states. They're, you know, if you think you're still in Kansas, you're not in a jhana. When you start having these experiences, you know, and I've definitely marinated in the first two, and I've had tastes of this third and fourth. So, you know, it's like, wow. Wow. This is really different. Okay, then that's where you are. But we can move in that direction, including toward what's called access concentration, which is like the doorway to, or has some of the qualities of a jhana. So the five factors of the jhanas are totally psychological, and they're very accessible, and they're worth cultivating. And it can be a kind of checklist for yourself when you meditate. The first one is applied attention. You're applying attention to some object of attention, like the sensations of breathing. So you check that. Okay? Am I applying attention with just enough deliberateness and effort to lock on to the target? Let's say the sensation of exhaling. And then second factor is sustained attention. Can I sustain attention, let's say for the duration of the exhalation? And then can I apply attention to the beginning of the inhalation and then sustain it throughout the inhalation? And literally, for advanced meditators as well as for intermediates or beginners, it's very helpful often to use counting. Just do it for 10 breaths in a row to really, really lock on almost every millisecond of 10 inhalations and exhalations in a row. That's no small thing. But you can do it, right? It's typically less than a minute of focused attention. But at the end of those 10 rides, 10 breaths you're gliding along, right? At the end of that, you're more concentrated. And then keep going. Applying, sustaining attention. Very important. Third factor is bliss, which may not be available, you know. What typically works is to focus on concentration for a while, and after 5-10 minutes in a row, then see if there can be a kind of rush of energy in the body, or physical pleasure often has a rising quality to it. You could do little things like breathe more rapidly. It's okay to manipulate yourself skillfully in this area. Not too much, but a little bit is helpful. Like, you know, I'll do a little thing like I'll pump at the base of my spine. I'll tighten the muscle there. Just for me, it helps somehow. And I'll feel this kind of, almost like a little mini rush. And often it'll just crumble. You can't sustain it. Don't chase it, because it won't come back. Go back to the breath, kind of build up the charge in the battery more and more, and then see again if you can tip into it. Some people have a lot of access to bliss. Some people have very little. I'm kind of in the middle. And also our circumstances, like pain, can affect us. But it's okay. The fourth factor is sukha, is joy. And there, it, you know, without chasing it, think of things that help you feel happy, like you're grateful for. You know, like it's the weirdest thing. Today's my father's birthday. He would have been 97 years old today if he hadn't died on Halloween. And I don't feel sad about that. I feel actually like, wow, Dad, you had such an amazing life. That makes me happy. The wonder of thinking about some kid born in North Dakota, November 25th, 1918, in literally a sod-walled house, right, delivered at home by some literally Norwegian midwife. Living a life like, wow. Or whatever it is that makes you feel happy, or maybe just locating happiness in the moment. So locate, then here's the key. You can make happiness your object of concentration. Gratitude. You can move from the breath to gratitude. See what I'm saying? You can become increasingly absorbed in gratitude. Or some other version of positive emotion, like feeling safe or relieved, like I'm all right. Wow. Normally I'm so anxious. How wonderful to realize I'm okay most of the time. Right? Okay? You got what I'm saying?
About 4 or 5 years ago, we had brought in some guest speakers, a couple.
Oh, yeah. Tina and Stephen.
Yeah. Over at the Falker.
Uh-huh.
And I came away from that thinking that to achieve this jhana, these jhana states, it's going to take a lot of time. Uh-huh. I mean, hours and hours and hours and days.
Right. Or more.
Do you speak to them?
Briefly on that point, I respect their friends. I, you know, good, and they're trained in a particular tradition in Southeast Asia. And the main teacher of that is Pa Ok Sayadaw. Sayadaw is the title. Pa Ok Sayadaw, and massive respect for that tradition. In that tradition, it's a very refined, very time-consuming, very structured, step-by-step. You don't go to step 4 until you've really nailed step 3, and there are 2,800 steps, you know, kind of thing. You really, not quite so many, you know, but several dozen. You really, really nail it. And from that view, you're right. Those definitions of the jhanas, you need to go through that incredible process. On the other hand, I just think there are many real examples of people who drop into these non-ordinary states that are transformative. They're not just kind of cool, but they actually make a difference, who don't have anything like that kind of training. And I also think that per one of my own key teacher, Christina Feldman, who's very deeply trained in those more serious, elaborate systems, she said, well, you know, maybe there are different kinds of jhanas. And as long as those non-ordinary states of consciousness are really changing you from the inside out, it's okay. Go after it. Minimally at home. Every single one of you can work the 5 jhana factors. You can work applying attention. You can work sustaining attention. You can invite bliss. If it doesn't come, it's okay. You can always access the joy factor, happiness, contentment, tranquility. And tranquility, let's remember, is one of the 7 factors of awakening, you know. And joy at the welfare of others is one of the 4 great Brahma-viharas, the immeasurables, the divine abodes, the resting places of the gods, so-called. Happiness at the good fortune of others. So there are many opportunities, you know, to access very powerful factors in at home, thinking of things that make you feel happy. Right? And then taking that as your object of attention. So you just increasingly become absorbed in that. Does it make sense? You can do it. You have that experience, and then you sink into it. Okay? And then the fifth factor is, and I'll finish on this, it's called unification of consciousness, singleness of mind. It has a quality of a kind of gestalt, everything coming together, kathunk. Here you are, no place to go, no desire to go anywhere else, no problem here, all integrated, thunk. And there's obviously a depth to this factor that you get to when you're doing a lot of meditating, like on retreat. But anyway, that's accessible to us all. Start out with, it can help to just establish that applied and sustained attention, like to your breath. I flip it. I go after sukha first, and then I see if any bliss comes later. Go after joy first, and then see if bliss comes later. Do that. And then see if you can kind of gently help a feeling of landing to happen, where you're just here in this beautiful state of mind, no basis for craving, and then just kind of marinate there. That's what I do. And then when you're there too, you can really just kind of get, wow, I don't have to be uptight about anything. I don't have to fight anything. I'm not chasing anything. All these thoughts rumble through my mind. Got to get this, got to fight with that. I don't actually have to. It's all okay already. And it's amazing to think of that, to finish here, as deep practice. It's not California-style Buddhism, you know. It's Northern India-style Buddhism, to marinate in samadhi. Okay? Enjoy. Giving thanks. Thank you. Let's just marinate in this for a minute. Maybe thinking of something in particular that you feel grateful for. And it's really natural and normal that, you know, as a stage, we might work with intensifying the happiness of these experiences, you know, the rewardingness of them. And it's natural that over time, they tend to subside into a kind of global well-being. Inner peace. It's like samadhi is enjoying as a path of practice, right? Enjoying loving, right? Enjoying living, enjoying eating. enjoying working, enjoying as a path of practice. I had a teacher who authored a book called The Eating Gorilla Comes in Peace. And there's something about that as we enjoy fighting, struggling, fussing and feuding falls away. Right? Enjoying as deep practice. Experiencing enjoying. Enjoy. Bye. Take care.
Thank you, Rick.